Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up,
sometimes the people that you most distrust turn out to be the most honorable ones, and the people that you do trust, they are not the honorable ones.
President Trump on his summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will have the latest on what the two leaders actually accomplished. Also today, State Attorney General Maura Healey has filed a lawsuit against Purdue Pharma, makers of OxyContin.
Their strategy was simple. The more drugs they sold, the more money they made, and the more people died.
And what does Southern food mean, and whom does it belong to? Culinary historian Michael Twitty sets out to find an answer.
It was more than just, let's stop worshiping ingredients. Let's stop worshiping food and start understanding the ethical importance of understanding the people that make the food.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Big on bluster, short on details. That's the distillation of last night's meeting between President Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un in Singapore. The two shook hands, standing in front of a phalanx of American and North Korean flags, a photo op that underscored the dramatic, historic, and political implications of yesterday's meeting between two impulsive leaders of nuclear nations who've spent months swinging between public taunts and diplomatic overtures. As for hardcore deal-making and results, President Trump said he was confident that North Korea would begin denuclearization, quote, very quickly, though he offered no details as to how or when that would happen. Trump also pledged that the United States would stop its joint military exercises with South Korea. The president explained that decision in an interview with ABC's George Stephanopoulos following the summit.
And I'm doing something that I've wanted to do from the beginning. We stopped playing those war games that cost us a fortune. We're flying planes in from Guam and we're bombing empty mountains for practice. And I said, I want to stop that and I will stop that. And I think it's very provocative, especially, George, since we're getting along.
Well, for more, let's turn now to Dr. Catherine Moon. She's the Edith Stix Wasserman Professor of Asian Studies and a Professor of Political Science at Wellesley College, and she joins us now. Kathy Moon, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Meghna.
Well, first of all, let's start with what the president said. He said, we're getting along, we being the United States and North Korea, but that announcement about ending those joint military exercises seemed to catch South Korea completely off guard.
It caught South Korea, the government, off guard, the people off guard, and it also caught our own Pentagon off guard. The U.S. Forces Command in South Korea put out a statement through the Public Affairs Office that they are proceeding with training and plans for an August joint military exercise as per the regular program, that they had gotten no command instructions to do otherwise. So Mr. Trump went ahead. He had no military official, a high-ranking one, in Singapore with him. He went ahead and basically changed U.S. policy, longstanding U.S. policy. We could, of course, reduce the joint military exercises, and I believe we really should. That 300,000 people that we have every spring is over the top, and the North Koreans absolutely go bonkers when that happens. However, you cannot be an ally of another country and just decide on your own, without consulting your own Defense Department, that you're going to change policy.
Okay. But so on the other hand, though, the president talked repeatedly about this issue of trust and that he seems to trust Kim Jong-un here. Let's turn back to some of the conversation that President Trump had with George Stephanopoulos, because he pointed out to President Trump during that conversation that regarding some of the agreements or overtures that seemed to have happened at yesterday's summit, that Kim Jong-un's father had made similar promises in the past, only to go back on them.
And he talks about that. He said that, you know, there are reasons he didn't, because he was let down by the United States, but that's irrelevant. What he's doing, and he very much said that. He said, you know, over the years, First of all, they've never gone this far. You know, they've never been at a level like this. And his father never dealt with the president and a lot of other things. But he said, it's very much in his mind. He said, we are going to get this done.
Kathy Moon, what's your response to that?
Trust is something you save for a relationship when you can really know that the partner is reliable. Right now, North Korea is completely untested territory. It is merely a first date. You cannot trust anyone on a first date. And I think Mr. Trump may be fooling himself if he thinks that he can trust Kim at this very moment. What Trump might have been alluding to is what we call confidence-building measures in the real world. And that is technical baby steps as well as other kinds of diplomatic measures to increase the opportunity to meet, to interact, to engage, to cooperate, and over time, build trust. So far, we don't have any evidence that the U.S. and North Korea can be trustworthy partners to each other.
Okay. Well, Kathy Moon, stand by for just a second, because I want to bring in another guest in this conversation. He's Dr. James Mueller, and he's a cardiologist and co-founder of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. The group won the 1985 Nobel Peace Prize, and they've actually also had some 5 meetings with North Korean officials since December talking about preventing nuclear war. Dr. Mueller, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Okay, so you had those 5 recent meetings with North Korean officials. I presume these were back channel meetings, right?
They were through the New York channel.
Okay. So in light of the conversations that you've had with high-level officials from North Korea in the past several months, what's your take on what came out of that summit? Can Kim Jong-un be trusted?
I agree with Kathy. You develop trust over a period of time, and it can't come from one meeting. But I think there's a process there that could possibly build trust. The idea that we would decrease some of the maneuvers, I think, you know, once the Pentagon orders are straightened out, might help build some trust. And, of course, it will take things from the North Koreans to build trust. I can tell you when I met with the ambassadors at the United Nations, we reviewed the medical effects of nuclear weapons on Manhattan. You know, I talked about what kind of firestorm there will be, hundreds of thousands of people burned to death, crush injuries, radiation injuries, people going towards Brooklyn. I mean, we basically reviewed the scene. And they are just as determined to prevent a nuclear war as we are.
Okay. So let me just ask you, though. I mean, we don't know any details because there have to be continuing negotiations regarding what denuclearization even means in the current context, because there were no details coming out of yesterday's summit between Trump and Kim. But it's nuclear weapons that got us to this point. I mean, what I'm saying is it's nuclear weapons that got Kim to the table with Donald Trump. They gave him the leverage, the international leverage, to have a meeting with the president of the United States. Is it truly imaginable under any circumstance that he would give up the very tools by which he has achieved a sort of security and international legitimacy?
I don't know what will happen. You know, I know that the North Koreans would like an armistice. They would like aid. They would like medical cooperation. President Trump's view. You saw the movie that they showed to Kim Jong-un saying how bright the future could be. There are many things they want. Perhaps they would give them up. But our group is actually more interested in a bigger problem. There are 9 nations that have nuclear weapons now, because North Korea is just a symptom of an underlying problem of nuclear weapons. We think they should all be abolished.
Kathy Moon, what's your response to that?
Well, I'm all for the abolishment of nuclear weapons in general, although the genies come out of the bottle, and it's really hard to stuff the genie back in. I think as far as North Korea goes, Kim Jong-un, I don't think he will give up all of his weapons, but I do think that he is serious about his determination to turn the crusty old ship of state, literally the DPRK, his country, from a backwater to a country that can enjoy some modern benefits, experiences for its people. I do think his interest in economic restructuring, in cultural development, and some kind of political normalization, whatever that might mean, with the rest of the world, I think he is serious about it, but he would face a lot of challenges at home domestically in order to keep on that path. And that is an area, the domestic politics of North Korea, that many of us need to pay more attention to. He has to make sure that there will be little resistance from the military. Mm. And we already know that the military, there are conservatives, hawks in the military, who are not happy about this situation, even talking about denuclearization.
Right. So Dr. Mueller, let me get you to respond to that, because to Kathy Moon's point, Professor Moon's point, it seems as if, is it possible even that Kim Jong-un would be at risk from, you know, members of the North Korean military who see nuclear weapons as too important to give up, let alone Kim's own desire to retain them?
I assume that there are factions within North Korea with different points of view, with different weighting to domestic development versus the military. I mean, that's the way it is in our country. Most countries have that split point of view.
Hmm. But to your broader goal of basically denuclearizing the world, I would agree. I think they're terrible weapons of mass destruction. But that genie is, as Professor Moon was saying, that genie is completely out of the bottle. Even our own president wants to spend billions of dollars to update our nuclear weapons infrastructure as well.
And so did Obama, President Obama.
Right. I mean, yes. So no leader who has it is going to give it up.
And what kind of course are we on? We have a Cuban Missile Crisis. We have the Cold War crisis in the 80s. We have the North Korean Missile Crisis. We're going to keep having nuclear crises, and eventually we won't be so lucky. People say that we're idealistic, that you can never get the genie back in the bottle. I prefer to say it the other way. I think it's idealistic to think that humanity can go on like this without catastrophe. Yeah. That's what Einstein said.
Well, going back to your meetings, your five meetings with North Korean officials, I mean, you talked about the concerns that you shared with them, but what did they tell you in return?
They surprised me. I said, I'm against all these weapons. I said, I think all of them should be gone. And they said, that's our policy.
To get rid of all nuclear weapons?
Yeah. Yes.
Can you trust them?
Well, you wouldn't.
They just built one. They've tested several.
Well, but our policy also is to get rid of all nuclear weapons. We signed that in 1968.
Yeah.
So, but there's a curious, Kathy and I were just talking about this. Most world leaders will say that they would like to get rid of all nuclear weapons. They'll often say it after they've left. But these, you know, we've banned biologic. We've banned chemical weapons. Why don't we ban the nukes?
Hmm. So, Kathy Moon, let me ask you the next question in this way. I was just looking at an op-ed in the New York Times that Victor Cha wrote today, right? He's the former National Security Council Director for Asia. And he said in this op-ed, only 5 months ago, based on his own conversations with the Trump administration, he thought we were headed down the inexorable path, those are his words, towards devastating war. But despite its many flaws, he says, quote, the Singapore summit represents the start of a diplomatic process that takes us away from the brink of war. Your thoughts?
I would agree with Victor. He is a friend of mine. And he also was the U.S. government's nominee for ambassadorship to South Korea. Mm-hmm. And that did not work out so well. But I think Victor's right. This is a different kind of a opening of a new show, let's speak in Trump terms, of a new program, TV program or entertainment show. For Trump, he thinks that if you make a big splash, which he did in Singapore, and then you hire people below you to follow up, that things will happen. But let's just assume that there will be no follow-ups. Let's assume that this is a one-off, because when you're dealing with diplomacy, when you're dealing with a country with whom you don't have formal diplomatic relations and is technically your enemy because we've never signed a peace treaty with North Korea after the Korean War, you can't assume that there will be a series of meetings and follow through. So if it's a one-off, then we have missed the opportunity to get some clarity about Kim Jong-un's real intentions and also capabilities. How far will he be able to go? How soon? How slow? Some kind of temperature needed to have been taken. Trump had no No reporter, no note taker in the meeting. And that is very disturbing because in the State Department protocol, you have note takers even at the lowest levels of meetings. Right. So we have no accountability
but
right now.
But let me just jump in here, though, Kathy, because on the other hand, the U.S. and North Korea have come to this point. I mean, you said let's assume that there will be no follow-on, but let's give the Trump administration the benefit of the doubt and say maybe there will be, and there might be significant follow-on. I mean, the president himself said that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is going to lead those negotiations, and all the devil is in all those details. So if there is follow-on, what needs to happen in the next steps?
I hope that Mr. Pompeo can take on that job with a single-minded focus. But he has got lots of other issues on the table, as we all know. What the U.S. and the DPRK would have to do is, number one, find out if the North Koreans are willing to maintain their freeze, their self-imposed moratorium on nuclear and missile testing, which they already announced, if they're willing to do that indefinitely, because that is one thing. That's the minimum that Mr. Trump should have gotten out of Mr. Kim publicly in Singapore, which did not happen. We also then need to find out, are the North Koreans willing to invite and host independent inspectors to survey the landscape? Three, dismantlement of actual nuclear production facilities, and four is complete disarmament.
Yeah.
That is a really tall order.
Just got a couple seconds left, Dr. Mueller. Last thought.
First thing that should be done is to take the weapons off alert. The button that Kim Jong-un has that he says can reach the United States should be disconnected, and so should the buttons that Trump has to launch weapons within 10 minutes without consulting anyone.
Well, that's Dr. James Mueller. He's a cardiologist and co-founder of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. They won the 1985 Nobel Peace Prize. Dr. Mueller, thank you so very much. And Dr. Catherine Moon, she's the Edith Stix Wasserman Professor of Asian Studies and a Professor of Political Science at Wellesley College. Professor Moon, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It was nice being with you, Meghna.
Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey is suing Purdue Pharma, maker of the powerful painkiller OxyContin. Healey announced a civil suit against the company's top executives and family members of Raymond Sackler, Purdue Pharma's founder. Last June, Healey, along with more than 35 other attorneys general, announced a joint investigation into the marketing practices of opioid manufacturers. And in a press conference today, Healey alleged that the individuals, quote, created the opioid epidemic and profited from it through a web of illegal deceit.
Through the course of our investigation, as alleged in today's complaint, we found that Purdue misled doctors, patients, and the public about the real risks of their dangerous opioids, including OxyContin. We also found that they did this. They did this with the oversight in direction of 16 current and former executives and directors named in our complaint. Their strategy was simple. The more drugs they sold, the more money they made, and the more people died.
Purdue Pharma responded with a statement today saying the company, quote, vigorously denies Healey's allegations and that its executives are, quote, disappointed that in the midst of good faith negotiations with many states, the Commonwealth has decided to pursue a costly and protracted litigation process, end quote. Now, more than 20 other states have already filed similar lawsuits against Purdue Pharma. And in 2007, the company also reached a $630 million settlement with the federal government. However, today's announcement from Healey comes several weeks after a stunning recent report from the New York Times that showed that in 2007, regarding that 2007 federal case, prosecutors had actually gathered what they believed was evidence that Purdue Pharma execs knew about significant abuse of OxyContin in the first years after the drug had been approved by the FDA, and they wanted to charge top Purdue Pharma execs with felonies that could have sent the executives to prison if convicted. But those 2007 efforts came grinding to a halt after Purdue's legal team held a previously unknown meeting with political appointees in the Bush Justice Department, after which the government backed down. Yesterday, we spoke with reporter Barry Meyer, who broke the story of the federal government's decision not to prosecute Purdue Pharma.
Let me put it in the simplest possible terms. I covered this story for 17 years. I wrote a lot of stories for the Times about it. I wrote a book about it. It was about a year and a half ago that I got this report. And I can only describe my reaction as one stunned by how much prosecutors had found out about this company, what they knew about this company and its behavior, and also heartsickened by the fact that had this information come out when it should have come out, that it would have had a very powerful impact on the trajectory of the opioid epidemic. And you know, we wouldn't be dealing with the scope of the epidemic that we are today had this information come out a decade ago.
The Massachusetts Department of Public Health estimates that in 2017, there were more than 2,000 opioid-related overdose deaths in the state. And in its statement today, Purdue Pharma added, quote, "We will continue to work collaboratively with the states toward bringing meaningful solutions." And we've got a link to our conversation with Barry Meyer and more coverage of Maura Healey's lawsuit against Purdue Pharma at RadioBoston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's talk a little bit about food. It's about flavor. Food is about history. It's about love. You know, putting a little soul into what we eat. But what happens to that soul when machines step in?
Spice is a brand new restaurant concept. It's the world's first restaurant featuring a robotic kitchen.
That's Michael Ferret, CEO of Spice, the new robotic restaurant in Downtown Crossing. Radio Boston producer-reporter Jamie Bologna and I visited a couple of weeks ago on the restaurant's first day.
That's
the first bowl!
That's the first bowl, so it's right over here.
So there aren't futuristic robot chefs here that have swapped tokes for cybernetic control systems. Spice features 7 automatic mixing and cooking bowls that spin and heat up fresh ingredients.
And it's kind of mesmerizing to watch as an orange ingredient delivery system slides back and forth above each one of the woks.
That orange box, we call that the runner. That's sort of what collects the different ingredients for your meal, and it delivers them to one of the cooking woks. What you see over here, the 7 cooking woks, that's what sort of cooks, mixes, and sears your meal.
Right behind you, Marcos.
All right, so where am I?
All right, so what you're listening to here, that's the sound of our chicken and rice searing and sizzling in the robotic wok. Coming over this way a little bit, we're looking at the chicken and rice is about to end, so the contents just tilted down into the bowl.
Oh, wow.
The bowl's going to swivel back out, and then you're going to hear the sound of the wash over here. So that's sort of, it's kind of like a steam wash. It's a high-pressure hot water, gets all the particulate off and gets it ready for the next meal. It also sanitizes it, so it's nice and clean after.
The robot cooks and cleans. I'm kind of loving this. So maybe it's not surprising that Farid and his co-founders are graduates of
MIT.
We were in college, myself and my co-founders. We were at MIT, and we felt that we couldn't get a delicious, healthy meal at anything less than, say, $10 or $12. Obviously, we were, as engineers, this was the solution that we thought of.
So, I'm Italian-American. I love my mother's tomato sauce. I will readily admit it is not the best sauce in the world, but to me it is because it's made with love and care by a human being who matters to me. And I'm curious how you're hoping to capture that love and human spirit that goes into food, that it matters to so many people.
I think that's a very valid question. I think that's part of the way we design the experience. We recognize, firsthand that most people probably don't want to get their food from a mechanized system. And so you actually get your food with a smile from one of our garmagers. We have the robot really focus on what robots are good at. That's sort of the repetitive tasks, the hot tasks. Standing in front of a wok for hours is not, the most pleasant job to do. The garmagers focus on the customer service, and they focus on the hospitality aspect. And so you get a combination of the experience from the fun technology, but absolutely, the people are so important to the experience.
Jamie, let's be honest here for a second. The technology, It's new. It's cool.
And people at Spice on opening day loved watching the robot do its work.
But we walked outside because we had to get to the end of the line.
Which was going out the door.
And while we were waiting, you couldn't help it. Remember what you said?
I feel like I've partially seen our future. I don't know.
So when Stephanie V was getting her, we have to go outside now. The line's so long, it's like come outside
to
here.
Loop around to the other
end. Oh my gosh, Keytar Bear. Music. Hello, Keytar Bear. What's up?
You never know what you're going to see in Boston.
Keytar Bear next to a robot restaurant. Perfect Boston moment.
I am struck by the juxtaposition of where we are, because like there's Chipotle and Clover. There's also a Starbucks across the way and a Dunkin' Donuts next door. Like, I guess I wonder how many other ways things will get automated.
It is hard not to think of all the food service employees that robots like this will replace. It's hard. So I'm going to play devil's advocate, Jamie, right now. And I'm thinking, you know, he was making the point about how standing in front of a hot wok or a hot pan all day long, it's hard, greasy, you know, uncomfortable work. So, you know, why not try to make that easier or remove that from what like a human has to do? And as long as there's now I'm not convincing myself anymore. As long as there are other jobs for that human.
I just want to say I haven't said anything so far in response.
I'm talking myself out of my own devil's advocacy.
But no, because I think I don't actually think it's about today's restaurant. I think it's about tomorrow's restaurant.
Yes.
Well, and, I mean, he did say he wanted to bring the cost down from $12, but I don't know where the $12 bowls are.
Wait, so, but the bowls are still $7.50. That's like the same price as a Chipotle bowl.
But maybe it's about bringing down the cost for them.
Well, yeah.
I don't think a robot requires healthcare, although it probably requires maintenance.
Yeah, a taste test is going to really determine this, yeah. I think.
Jamie, I really enjoyed that. Waxing philosophical with you about how there's no industry, seriously, that's immune to the effects of automation.
But, Magna, do you remember what happened when we finally got to the kiosks, that bank of touchscreens where you have to tap in your order?
Yes. The same thing that happens basically every time I use a CVS self-checkout machine.
It's okay, you hit cancel.
I just canceled.
No, but not the whole thing.
User error. It's not working.
All right, let me get help. A human being to the rescue.
Now, you see, I was expecting to not have to bother an actual person.
Oh, no, it's okay. That's what I'm here for.
Okay.
There was some issue with the payment.
And she tapped a couple of screens and fixed it.
Right, so then we waited along with this big crowd of people watching the robot deliver and heat and mix our food bowls.
Okay, so do you see where it says your bowl?
No, I don't. No. It says ready to plate.
So there's a screen above every one of the robots saying like, now cooking bowl for whomever. Oh, hi,
look.
Jamie B.
And Megan C, we're completing cooking.
It
just plopped out, see? But so here's the thing. They've also figured out that like people will love seeing their name up on a board and take a picture of it.
And they were doing exactly that. Remember, Jamie? Like smartphone selfies with the restaurant robot.
But of course, as we've been saying, the real test is the food itself. So, Magna, we grabbed our bowls and we sat down next to Alicia Fay and Louis Baroa.
It's pretty cool that, like, we thought it was going to be more like robot servers or something like that, but that they're, like, actually cooking the food and dropping. And it's really cool how, like, you look up and it's like, hi, Alicia, and I'm cooking your meal, and you can see it rotating around in there. And then you're really surprised that it tastes really good because you're like, well, what do robots know about flavor?
Because I keep worrying about, like, what about the restaurant workers that the robots are replacing?
There's always place for human touch, you know what I mean? Like, you can't replace.
There's always a place for a human, yeah, because, I mean, there's definitely things that the robot.
Someone had to buy the ingredients. Someone had to put those stuff together, you know?
The humans
it's a cool
are good,
thing.
Too, here.
Yeah, the human part is really pretty friendly. Nice. I mean, I came for the robots. I stayed for the humans, so.
Okay, Jamie.
All right,
ready?
So we try this.
All right.
Magna C.
You got the what?
I got the Thai bowl.
Okay, and I got the Indian bowl. It's like a robot hybridization of a classic Indian meal that you'd find in Mumbai. So they have tamarind and like crispy rice and this these tiny little things called shave and raisins. And I mean, it's like Mumbai street food. It's like the robot version of that. All right, here I go. Gonna try it.
Oh no, your face is telling me everything, which no one else can see, but you're crinkling up your nose here. You didn't like it.
No, I didn't. I mean, it was just kind of, I don't know, a strange warm mixture of this kind of mishmashy set of curry flavors, Jamie. I mean, okay, let's just put it this way. My mom's food is not going to be replaced by a robot anytime soon. There is no fear of that.
Of course. And then I tried the Thai bowl, and your judgment was just as harsh. Here's what you said.
Like, it kind of tastes the same.
Yeah. I wonder if that's the challenge of a series of tubes splotting out ingredients and mixing them together.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fundamental challenge of any automation. The easiest, most straightforward way to automate anything is to make everything the same. I mean, Henry Ford knew that in the early 20th century. You can have any color of car you want as long as it's black.
Right. And you can have any grain bowl you want as long as it's peanut curry.
As long as it's some, like, weird melange of, like, various Western interpretations of Asian flavors.
But, Meghna, the car analogy also means Henry Ford had it right.
Right, because today, cars made by both humans and robots,
they're everywhere right now, all over the world. So maybe one day restaurant robots will be too.
We are the robots. We are the robots.
Well, Radio Boston producer and reporter Jamie Bologna there with me on a trip to Spice, the first robotic kitchen in Boston or pretty much anywhere in the world. Jamie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
We'll be back talking a little bit more about food, its history, and its heart. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to spend the next part of the show talking more about food, but this time also about identity. Culinary historian Michael Twitty has made it his personal mission to explore the intimate connections between food and race in America by diving deeply into his own family history, from enslavement to freedom and from Africa to the Old South of America. Because this concept of Southern food, it's essential to the American tradition of and American cuisine. But there's a really important question here. Who does that tradition belong to? And how can food bring about cultural understanding and even healing? Well, Michael Twitty's James Beard award-winning memoir is called The Cooking Gene, A Journey Through African-American Culinary History in the Old South. He's in town now as the scholar-in-residence at the Jewish Arts Collaborative, and he joins me now in the studio. Michael Twitty, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
It's a real pleasure to have you here, and there's so much to talk about, but I was just wondering if we could actually just start by giving folks a little sense of how and what you write in the book, and I was wondering if you could just read an excerpt from it.
Sure. I dare to believe all Southerners are a family. We are not merely Native, European, and African. We are Middle Eastern and South Asian and East Asian and Latin American now. We are a dysfunctional family, but we are still a family. We are unwitting inheritors of a story with many sins that bears the fruit of the possibility of 10 times the redemption. One way is through reconnection with the culinary culture of the enslaved, our common ancestors, and restoring their names on the roots of the Southern tree and the table those roots support. The Old South is where I cook. The Old South is a place where food tells me where I am. The Old South is a place where food tells me who I am. The Old South is where food tells me where we have been. The Old South is where the story of our food might just tell us where America is going. The Old South with soul food in its mouth. And I, who am African-American, must know her.
That's Michael Twitty reading from his book, The Cooking Gene, A Journey Through African-American Culinary History in the Old South. I wanted to have you start our conversation by reading that, because when I look at that, I hear you talking about the Old South, which is a place in time. It's a geographical place,
but it's also a place in the soul. So when you say Old South, what do you mean?
Well, first, you know, you kind of triggered me by having me reading that because I wrote like, okay, it brought me back to like when I did the book for like Audible and I had to do that for 7 days. Yeah. Same time it took the Lord to make the world, you know. Hearing my own voice now reading the book, I'm like, oh my God, I'm back to doing it.
Well, you did a great job.
Oh, thank you. But no, the Old South is pejorative if you're black, and rightly so. It's like saying, you know, the grand golden days of the British Empire in India. It's like, what? You know, the great old West, huh? So to us, it's also a place of cultural memory that is painful. And it's like an act of reclamation. It's kind of like inward reclamation to me. Because the Old South is a place where we imagine that the black man and woman are disempowered unless they are there to serve white folks. And so for me, that Old South image, which is still embedded in our food culture, embedded in the popular image of the South, is also the image I have to, like, hug to death.
Yeah.
And I literally mean that. I mean, take it, hug it, and then there's no life in it until the only meaning it has is what I give it to it as a descendant of the people who supported that institution.
So tell me more about how that, you said it's embedded in our food culture still to this day. Tell me more about that.
What's the biggest fast food brand in the world? Yum Brands. What's their biggest, who's their lead business? Kentucky Fried Chicken. Colonel Harlan Sanders was from Indiana. So why is he dressing up like a Southern plantation owner? Mm-hmm. Why did he leave that legacy after his passing to us as the idea of him in a white suit with a black bow tie as the Kentucky Colonel? That's deep.
Mm-hmm.
We still have Aunt Jemima. We still have Uncle Ben. We still have the Cream of Wheat Man. We still have these embedded images of the power imbalance in the Old South based on food. The context is still there, but the material is there, but the context isn't. And so for me, a part of reapproaching our tradition was breaking down that wall, going, okay, this is not the reality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you do that? How did you try to break down that wall?
First, you know, you ask questions. You ask, where do I come from? A lot of people don't know the African-American story as well as they think they do. You know, the playwright, award-winning playwright George C. Wolfe, you know, had an amazing opening scene to his play The Colored Museum, where he has enslaved people come on a plane from Africa, and it's a slave ship plane. And the crew, the plane director says, the stewardess says, I'm going to hand you some basketballs. You're going to become millionaires after you sing some songs for 300 years. And that is a stereotype of black history. Whereas for me, when I'm writing this book and I'm talking about food, it's kind of like our ancestor now, Anthony Bourdain, who challenged us to see beyond just the food and see the people, the culture, their passions, their politics, their issues. And it's like, well, I have to go back to where my people came from. Who were my people? Who are my people? Native, European, African, Asian, etc. Where did they come from? Why did they come from there? What did they eat? What did they bring to the table? And also, can I trace? Can I be the Alex Haley of our food tradition and trace where those dishes and where those ideas came from that became Southern food, that became soul food?
Yeah. Well, so you say in your book that you wanted to have a confrontation with the quarter of a white man lurking in your body.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Because that's what it is. I think most people don't realize when you look at an African-American person, especially someone like me, medium brown to darker, you don't see the layers of multi-ethnicity there. Whereas there are other African-American folks and other people from the African diaspora where it's plain and evident that mixture has taken place. And so for me, I got tired of people putting me in that one box. Like this book is about celebrating my African heritage. And of course, the paperback will have me going to the continent, which is great. Fantastic. Happened after the book came out, though. But it's more important than that. I just really want to confront the European part of my heritage, and also take claim of ownership of that part of who I am and tell people, you know, I've always wanted to walk in the St. Patrick's Day parade. You know why? Because guess what? There's a lot of us black folks. You hear that, Boston? A lot of us black folks who are part Irish and Scots Irish. That's the reality of early American history, and it's a legacy, and Caribbean people as well. So, we are a mixed multitude. And if we are family to you, if we are all family, no matter what region we come from, where we come from the world, then we should change the tone and tenor of our dialogue with each other.
Mm-hmm. So, there's so much to talk to you about. I'm trying to tame my mind here a little bit. But, I mean, you go to the Oak Forest Plantation, or the site of the Oak Forest
yes.
Plantation in Nash County, North Carolina,
yep.
in part of this effort to confront.
The Southern Discomfort Tour.
What did you find there?
Well, I found the big house. I found the offices. One thing I didn't, the kitchen was in ruins, but I saw where the kitchen was. I saw about how big the kitchen would have been. It was pretty astounding. I was confronted with the grave of my white fifth great-grandfather, who was born during the Revolution and died during the beginning of the height of the antebellum South. And it was his grandson that fathered my great-great-grandmother in Alabama. So I was actually looking at this plantation, and by the way, it's still surrounded by cotton and tobacco fields. It's mm-hmm. like the whole image is there. It's very haunting. And I didn't know how to feel. I didn't know how to feel towards this man. And one of the things about that part of the book is, based on his probate record, which was amazing. I mean, he had steak plates and waffle irons and the beaten biscuit breaker and all these. For me as a culinary person, it's like wild, like. Not only was he wealthy, but he had a very well-stocked, he obviously liked to eat. And I said, well, that's the genetic connection right there, right? But beyond that, I started extracting like these ingredients from his probate record. Because, you know, food was a part of that. He actually bought rice, homegrown rice from an African-American man who may have been free called Luke, and brought onions from him. And I'm thinking, oh, wow. So they would have had rice with onion gravy, and they would have had ham, and they would have had turkey, and they would have had fried chicken and waffles, and they would have had apples and brandy and peaches. And I went, wait a minute, you would never have been allowed to eat with your own fifth great-grandfather. You wouldn't have had that power, that ability to define your reality in those terms at that time. And that is the conundrum that we face when we confront our history.
Yeah. I was just wondering about that because you're right. Like every item that you just described, that would have been what the slave owners
mm-hmm.
would have been eating.
Right. But a black woman would have been cooking it.
Right. So tell me more about that. You said your great-great-grandmother? I want to be sure I get this right.
Yes, great-great.
So she was an enslaved woman. Do you know more about her, what she was doing there?
So she was born during the Civil War. A couple of years ago, I actually was able to find through one of the DNA sites our distant cousins, who were also African-American. Well, apparently he only had black children, one in Texas, one in Alabama. So we had a 150-year-old reunion in process. I actually went to Texas and met them and met my cousin. And the DNA was on point with our oral history. He was their great-grandfather, our great-great-great-grandfather. And so it was kind of bizarre. But it was also very true to the reality of the quote-unquote Old South. And there's a food connection always with this. Because this was a man who was raised on the cooking of African-American people. The kitchen, as I always say, was a place of trigger and trauma, because the kitchen in the Old South was an offshoot building. So, you know, I do this for a living. I actually go and demonstrate and cook this way and cook in the tradition of 18th and 19th century enslaved people and free people of color. It's very important people understand that. It wasn't just enslaved people innovating this early American cooking. And I just think about what that meant when you could, like, lock that door. And no one would know anything until, of course, gestation happens, birth happens, and there's a child that looks just like the man in that big house. And in my family, it's a frequent story. That's how I got to that quarter weight man. And it was through the kitchen. It was through those enslaved people who worked in the house. And it's led to me, you know, on my journey, I didn't take that lightly. It was one of the first times when I actually had the experience of breaking down emotionally, mm-hmm. and, you know, having a serious confrontation with the blood in my own veins. But I don't say this to discourage connection, because one of the things I have to tell you is that for a lot of the people who I outreach to who are white, who are the descendants of these people or collateral descendants, they were actually very willing to help me with my journey and tell me whatever they knew. A little bit wary, a little bit scared at what I might say or think. But I came to them with the attitude of the African-American identity is like a mosaic with so many missing parts. Just by giving us a little bit of our past back is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit more about, you know, like you said, cooking the food?
Yeah.
Because I completely hear you when you say, like, it was a emotional experience that breaks you down, because food can do that, right? It just,
yeah.
It connects us in this profound sort of almost atavistic way, because it's
yeah.
so primal, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so tell me more about what it was like to, like, recreate these recipes and using the ingredients that you're, like, reaching back in time and touching your ancestors.
Yeah, right? And you're going there and you're these heavy pots with the water and the fire and chopping the wood and being up early in the morning and working throughout the whole day and really thinking about what that really would have been like. You know, when I went to West Africa, I went to Senegal, Ghana, and Nigeria so far. I'm on a West Africa binge now. And I remember the first time I saw a kitchen in the village, like one of the traditional villages in Senegal, and tears. I mean, I couldn't stop crying. Because as I said to my the people who were allowing us in, I said, I've been here before. And they understood exactly what I meant. And the Senegalese, one of the Senegalese people said to me, Michael, you are... we are your new family, but you are our old family. Hmm. And so that really, you know, eating the food with them, eating the okra, eating the hot peppers, pounding fufu. And, you know, when we pounded fufu in Ghana, we went as a group of chefs to kind of like on a cooking gene tour of Ghana. And we were pounding fufu with them. And there's two dudes, me and my play brother Harold, pounding fufu, which is not a dude's job, even though it's very hefty, you know. And we made the women smile because we started singing a song from slavery time, but we just replaced the word rice with yams. And they just started clapping on cue and singing on cue like they had always known this song. And they were smiling, and it was an immediate sort of like, we get you. You know, they said to us, welcome home. Hmm. And that's just like the feeling that I want everybody to have, no matter what their background is. Anybody can have a cooking gene journey. Anybody can break down the various parts of their identity, their culture, their family story, and connect to other people around the globe.
Yeah.
You know, we might be cousins because, you know, I have a little South Asian. So, you know, hey, I'll bring you to the next family reunion.
You send me the invite, I will be there.
All right. Awesome. Awesome. Awesome.
Can I just ask you kind of a slight tangential question? Because, you know, you include some recipes mm-hmm. In the book as well. West African brisket, black-eyed pea hummus, which sounds amazing. Your mom's apple crisp, right?
Right.
So how'd you decide what to include?
I wanted things that were uniquely me and my story, not just, you know, whatever. I didn't give away my grandmama Nam's fried chicken recipe because that's like gold. I don't play that. but I did put in the things that, show my Black and Jewish identity, or the things that show my emotional connection to my mom, or things that show like the hard tack of slavery, that ash cake and trough mush, you know, people used to eat from a trough. I mean, I wanted people to see that the food is not just about comfort, and that sometimes, yes, it is about comfort. It's about love. The food is our DNA.
Mm-hmm. You know, since you offered it to us like a little hidden gem there when you talked about your Black and Jewish identity, for folks who don't know your story, you want to just explain
a tiny bit. Yeah. So I'm actually going to be my next project. This book is part of a trilogy. And, you know, I'm very grateful that, you know, the cooking gene brought me 2 James Beard Awards, 1 Best Writing and 1 Best Book. But the next book is about my Jewish identity in Black Jewish food traditions and my relationship with Judaism. And the next book after that will center my gay identity and talk about how that relates to food. So it's like each identity will take turns being front and center, but the other parts will be there as well.
Well, Michael W. Twitty is author of the James Beard Award-winning memoir, The Cooking Gene, A Journey Through African-American Culinary History in the Old South. He'll be at the Jewish Heritage Center at New England Historic Genealogical Society tonight and the New England Center for the Arts and Technology tomorrow night. We've got information about that at radioboston.org. What a pleasure and a privilege it's been to speak with you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.